Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex, who have we got on today?
So we're continuing our dedicated week to African American history, and today we have Mark Peterson with us. He's a historian and entrepreneur, an African American born in the Jim Crow South, as were his parents before him. And he's here today to tell us about his very personal connection to Dr. Martin Luther King. Mark, welcome and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to learn more about Dr. King from you and to learn more about how your story ties in with him. We'll quickly talk about how he was so prominent by the events at Selma, but then I'm going to ask you, because I know that you're very interested in some of the other stuff he was doing and his other theories. But by 1955, I think it's safe to say that Dr. King was the most visible persona out there in the fight for civil rights, wasn't he? How did he get there?
Well, I think he was, some people say he was preordained. Mm-hmm. He was born Michael King, and name was changed to Martin because there was kind of a destiny that his family felt that he was born into, that he was expected to step into. After receiving his degrees and taking a leadership role in Montgomery, and then taking on the mantle of the civil rights movement and the bus boycott, I think that's really what thrust him onto the national stage because of the outcome of that particular protest. When you organize an entire city of people and take them from work to home every day for a full year and keep them off of a bus line that refuses to let you sit in the front of the bus, that's going to get some attention. And I think that's what people realized by that point, that he was going to be a different type of leader. By 1955, people knew that his philosophy was something that was completely unique in terms of organizing a national movement, when he aligned his thinking with that of Gandhi and saying that this revolution, this reform of American society could take place in a nonviolent way. So he had an expectation going into his early pastoral career that he would be an activist.
And that 1955, as you say, that bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, is what really, that's the catalyst for his future career, isn't it? You just briefly outlined it for us. For our listeners, who a lot of whom aren't in the US and maybe don't know, so it was based on segregation, wasn't it? It was the fact that black people were expected to sit at the rear of the bus and they weren't allowed to choose a seat, basically. And so Martin Luther King took everybody off the buses.
Right. Right. So you had Rosa Parks, who was the individual who became the target of the protest. She decided to defy the regulations and sit in the front of the bus. Prior to that, African-Americans were relegated to the back of the bus, or in cases where the buses were crowded, were forced to get off the bus. And she refused to give up her seat when told to move to the back of the bus. And then the subsequent outcome was a protest that led to all African Americans deciding not to ride that bus for over 365 days. So that's not a small feat when you think of a city the size of Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And you look at the number of individuals that had to continue to find a way to make sure that they were going to their jobs, fulfilling their duties so that they could be paid and feed their families. You know, those are the unsung heroes that a lot of the civil rights documentaries don't look at. Those individuals who had to march along with him, but also suffer the wrath of the protests and the backlash that went along with it. And that is a serious commitment to manage for that amount of time. That's not your typical protest where you show up for a day and march. That's a year of walking, riding, and staying focused on what the true outcome was, which was to change the policy in the state and in the South.
Because I think it also speaks volumes as to how inspirational a figure he was. that people were willing to do that with him, as you say, to suffer that hardship and suffer that wrath for 300 odd days.
Yeah, and you know, fortunately, there were forerunners prior to his time in Montgomery and in Alabama who were trying to get traction around these issues, both in Selma and in Montgomery. There were people who were trying to change those policies, who were trying to get people to vote, and they could not get the type of visibility that he could bring to the table. And I think that's where you have a real difference in some of the prior leaders, is that he had the force of personality, but he was also riding the tailwinds of new technology. As we see when we get to Selma, the broadcast television became a real factor in giving the civil rights movement additional power to influence those people who were on the middle of the fence, or those individuals who had not yet formed opinions on what was going on in the country. Prior leaders may have had prominence, but they didn't have the ability to speak to a nation in the way that Dr. King could. So we found ourselves with lightning in a bottle at that point. An individual who was extremely erudite could motivate and inspire intellectuals and the common man at the same time, and then a technology that could help amplify his voice to get people to come and participate in protests from all over the country. And we saw that culminate in Selma and in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. What about in 1962, the struggle against segregation in Albany, Georgia?
Now, that was one of his toughest protests, because part of Dr. King's nonviolent philosophy required personal sacrifice, but it also required a reaction from local officials that would garner the type of attention that would stimulate that kind of change. And when officials learned of his tactics, there were ways that you could defeat it. You know, you could nonviolently and less aggressively arrest people, put them into jails, and then address the issue head on. And Dr. King ran into some of that as he approached Selma, and not every instance was he able to get the outcome, particularly when you had an equally strategic local government and an equally patient local sheriff. And so Albany was a culmination of those types of events and did not yield the type of outcome Dr. King wanted. And so Selma became an opportunity to rebound from what happened in Albany, looking for a opportunity where he could get the visibility to thrust these issues that were happening at a local level onto a national scene. But Albany was a good wake up call for the movement, and a good opportunity for Dr. King to go back and be a tactician and look for a richer environment where he could emphasize the issues.
You've already mentioned Washington. This is 1963, and this is where he delivered his famous "I Have a Dream" speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. So can you describe to us a bit more about those events? Obviously, everybody knows that speech, or at least knows that line of that speech, but how did he come to be on those steps, and what was he trying to achieve there?
Well, that is that's probably one of the most famous speeches that you can that the world knows of outside of what happened in Selma. So in 1963, he helped organize the march, and he wanted to paint a picture of an integrated and unified America when he did the march on Washington. And so Dr. King, along with many other leaders, thought that DC would be the perfect place to have this march and to speak to the collective conscience of America. And, you know, there were a laundry list of other prominent leaders who played organizing roles in getting that march together. But when you, you know, look at the result of it, thousands of people who gathered in D.C. in 1963, his speech, in my opinion, that was kind of a real turning point in the movement, because it activated far many more non-blacks in understanding the true struggles of what was going on in the country. He worked alongside a number of groups, as you know, being the leader of the Southern Leadership Conference, and other groups like SNCC that were doing more local organizing, and then local pastors to also play a major role in getting that getting the Washington D.C. march underway. Dr. King, to me, in that instance, in that speech, like I said, defined the future path of what would be to come, in laying out that the issues that were being tackled weren't always going to be issues that dealt with just the social aspects of American society.
Mark, would you mind at this point if we asked you to read the end of that speech?
Yeah, the powerful part of the speech is where he picks up and starts with, "We must continue to work with the faith that unarmed suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and the ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, though and even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." To me, that's one of the most powerful parts of that speech, where he gives you a reason to fight for what is real in America, that dream. And that dream is the opportunity to be an equal participating part of America's society, all of that society.
There's a key line just near the end of the speech as well, isn't it, where he says, "And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true." And it still just holds so much weight.
It does, absolutely.
But Dr. King was much more than just an activist, wasn't he?
Yes. I think he was much more than an activist. If I were to categorize Dr. King, I categorize him as a strategist, a tactician, a businessman, a negotiator, a politician. He was all these things wrapped in a clergyman who had a view of religion and politics and economics that was unlike any other leader in his time. Mm-hmm. So he was a multifaceted person that could bring a lot to bear in terms of his strategic and organizing capabilities. So yes, he was somewhat of a different Renaissance civil rights leader than had been seen at the time.
So by 1964, he had won the Nobel Peace Prize for attempting to combat racial inequality through nonviolent resistance. And he had also become the first president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Right. Mark, this is where your background comes into play. You were raised in Selma, Alabama, and it was his role as the head of the SCLC that brought him there in 1965. But what was he hoping to achieve? And tell us about Selma at that time.
Selma, when you look at Selma from its demographics, that was pretty much Selma's peak. Population, size, economic wealth compared to what it is today. Selma was a thriving community. It was a separated community where Blacks, though nearly a majority in the county and in the city of Selma, had no representation. Less than 1% of the African-American population was registered to vote. So though there was economic power in the Black community, there were two hospitals, many doctors. There was a school system there that was controlled by Blacks. There was a lot of wealth being generated. There was no political representation to help harness that economic power at the time. And there were many leaders who were trying to correct that. So the Dallas County Voters League was headed up by Amelia Boynton, was trying to get people to see the benefit of registering to vote and to get leadership that would represent the interest of African Americans in Selma at that time. Having not gotten a lot of traction, she invited in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to try to do local voter registration campaigns in the city of Selma and in the county of Dallas County, not getting a lot of traction because of the organized resistance from the registrar and from political figures and law enforcement in Selma. When I say organized resistance, it was everything from education, literacy tests, to sometimes violence against those who were organizing the voter registration campaigns, all in an attempt to make sure that individuals did not register to vote.
And for our listeners at this point, it is the legal right of these African Americans to register to vote, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so the attempts that were put in place were to keep them from exercising that right. At the point where they were still not getting a lot of traction, Amelia Boynton, Dr. Frederick Reese reached out to Dr. King and wanted to pursue a different strategy to try to change what was going on in Selma. The difference was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was a lot of localized voter registration campaigns, all in a goal to try to stand up local leadership. Dr. King's approach, as I mentioned when we talked about Albany and what failed in Albany, was to do tactical strikes to get more visibility and then harness the collective conscience of a nation to change the laws at the national level, which then could be enforced at the local level. And so when he received the request, he saw Selma as a very ripe opportunity because there was already organized leadership that was committed to trying to make a change and a population that was behind that local leadership and that had suffered some of the reactions of the local government and local law enforcement. You had a sheriff and Sheriff Clark who they anticipated would be unhinged if pushed in the wrong directions, and that could play to the benefit of the movement. So Dr. King at that point saw Selma as a great second chance opportunity to push the issues of voter registration and voter rights in the South forward.
And you mentioned his tactical approach. His approach in this case, wasn't it? It was to have a massed peaceful march from Selma to Montgomery, 54 miles down the mm-hmm. highway, just a mass group of people peacefully marching from one to the state capitol to make themselves known, wasn't it?
Right. So that was kind of the culmination of a couple of different events. So one of the voter registration drives took place about 15 miles down the road in Marion, Alabama. And during one of those, one of the events, one of the marches and protest, a gentleman by the name of Jimmy Lee Jackson was shot, and that was by a state trooper by the name of James Fowler. And that took place on February, I think it's February 26th of 65. Jimmy Lee was a deacon and an activist. His mother was there at that march, peaceful march. And she was being attacked by the trooper. Jimmy Lee intervened and was subsequently shot and later died. And that sent a spark through the community in Marion, in Selma, Dallas County, and became the impetus for the march. It was for voter registration, but it also became a march that was going to put forth the issues that African Americans were facing when it came to law enforcement and violence that was perpetrated by law enforcement on Blacks, even in nonviolent, peaceful situations. And so Jimmy Lee became a rallying point for the march that brought a number of people who, again, were fence setters into the march because they wanted to have justice for Jimmy Lee. Mm-hmm. So, and when you look at today's situations that we're facing, much of what Dr. King talked about leading up to the march and after the march about police violence and voter registration, some of those issues we're still fighting with and in the throes with even today.
So now the first attempt is a complete failure. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the first attempt was on March 7th. And it was led by some prominent individuals that we know of today, John Lewis and Amelia Boynton. Dr. King was not in attendance at that first march. And the marchers began their march and got to the base of the Edmund Pettus Bridge and became aware of the state troopers, the newly deputized citizens, and Jim and Sheriff Clark and his men, who were on the other side of the bridge, awaiting the marchers. From their perspective, they believed they had the legal right to enforce an injunction which restricted the march from taking place. But the marchers felt like they were, in the words of Dr. King, who believed that unjust laws are just that. They're not just, mm-hmm. and you don't have to follow them. We're going to push forward anyway. When they reached the other side of the bridge, the call was made, and the troopers on horses, newly deputized citizens, and Sheriff Clark's men moved in with batons, with men on horseback, sticks, and tear gas, and attacked the protesters. Amelia Boynton, who will later again received national prominence, and John Lewis, who is a congressman in Georgia today, were beaten severely. Amelia Boynton was beaten unconscious, and John Lewis was beaten nearly to death on the foot of the bridge. Dogs, German shepherds were released on the crowd. Water hoses were sprayed on the protesters. It was a horrific scene, a scene that was captured by the press, was captured on televised media, and it was broadcast to the world, and it became the mirror reflection of American society that most Americans didn't want to see and didn't want to accept. But at that point, it was in their living room, and it became the issue that Dr. King was able to leverage and to put forth, particularly in front of pastors around the nation, and say, if you not only believe in this country, but if you believe in what you preach, you can't allow this to happen. You can't allow this to continue. You can't allow black protesters to suffer the brunt of this type of hostility. You have to come and march and be shoulder to shoulder with those protesters and show that there's a different America. So when he put that call out after that incident, it changed the perspective of the march, because it put local and national political leaders on the hot spot. Mm-hmm. You could turn your eye away from what was happening to black protesters, but suddenly when you have a diverse group of protesters that also included many prominent celebrities, you could no longer step back and ignore that. And Dr. King, as I mentioned, was a brilliant tactician. He knew that that first march was something that had to happen, mm-hmm. but he also knew that that event would be the trigger point to activate people to come from all over the nation to stand shoulder to shoulder with him. So yeah, it is a date, as has been said about World War II, that will live in infamy when we look back on American society. But it was also a turning point in what was right for America, because those who wanted to stand for that came to Selma and put their lives on the line, as we would see a couple of nights later in Reverend Reeb, who was attacked and killed.
Is a white man, isn't it?
Yes.
Who's come down from, is it Pennsylvania? Forgive me, I've forgotten.
Massachusetts, yes.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he came down from the Northeast, right. A white man, to take part in this, put his life on the line, and it cost him his life, didn't it?
It did. And you saw that even before and after the successful march, that there were individuals like Reverend Reeb who were killed. He was beaten and beaten to the point where he died from his injuries. And like Jimmy Lee, became the face of a situation that many believed had to change. So even if you weren't completely sold on all the tenets of what Dr. King preached in terms of the nonviolent change that he hoped to see, there were many Americans who just could not live with that sort of violence against American citizens. And so they came, in the thousands to Selma to right that wrong and to push for that change.
And the second attempt, Dr. King had made a deal, hadn't he?
Yeah, so the second attempt took place on March 9th. And then, Dr. King was still in the middle of a negotiation with the president and with the federal judges on whether or not the march could move forward. Not having the legal standing to march meant that they were not going to get the federal protections to march from Selma to Montgomery. And so Dr. King had to, again, be a tactician and figure out a way to make a statement while also staying within the law. And so the march, the second attempt, they marched shoulder to shoulder, two by two, to the Edmund Pettus Bridge and kneeled in prayer, along with several other prominent clergy who had traveled to Selma to be a part of the march. And then after praying, they returned back to the church where they initiated the march. Some people saw that as a defeat. Some people were angry that they turned back and didn't push forward because Sheriff Clark's men, the state troopers, the exact scenario that had happened in the first march on the 1st of March, were setting themselves up to repeat again, even though the troopers and the deputies were giving them the indication that they could move forward across the bridge. Dr. King suspected that they would get the same outcome, and he would get branded as a criminal for not respecting the injunction that was sent down by the federal courts. So a tactician's move was the right move in that instance, but it bought time for them to get the ruling they needed to get the federal protection for the marchers that would eventually come a few days later.
And tell us about the final attempt to march.
So the final attempt was put in place once the federal protections were afforded to the marchers, FBI, the newly controlled National Guard that was federalized by President Johnson. But prior to that, there were some tactical moves that were put in place, or at least attempted to try to give local leaders face-saving attempts to be on the right side of history. So George Wallace spent time with Johnson trying to hammer out an agreement where these marchers could be protected by state officials. That was unsuccessful. And when I kind of try to paint the scenario of how Dr. King was involved in all of this, he was staying with Richie Jackson, Dr. Jackson's wife and family. He stayed with them in Selma on the street that's now named for Amelia Boynton. He was on the phone during that period with the president, trying to figure out when they would take that next step, when they would take the successful march. Miss Jackson's daughter indicated that when they received the telephone bill at the end of the month, it was for $15,000.
Oh my God.
Now, $15,000 in 1965 dollars.
Buys you a house, right?
Well, yeah, back then, $15,000 would buy you a mansion.
Yeah.
$15,000 to even a prominent doctor like Dr. Jackson was an amount that you just could not, you couldn't raise to pay in order to keep a utility on like a telephone. They told Dr. King about the bill. Dr. King told the president, and suddenly the bill disappeared. There was no bill. Mm-hmm. So there were many different ways and tactics that Dr. King worked behind the scene before that march took place. The ultimate culmination, as I mentioned, was President Johnson, once the legal footing was in place, then activated the protections, and they put a limit of 300 marchers who could leave out of Selma and travel the 54 miles to Montgomery. And so they proceeded along at a generous pace from Selma after getting those types of protections. And when I tell people about protections, people have to understand that period was probably the most volatile Selma has ever seen. Dr. King, when he stayed with the Jacksons, every night, the Secret Service would go through the entire house, take everything out of every shelf, go underneath every bed, crawl underneath the house and check for bombs. Mm-hmm. Every night. The Jacksons had a 3-year-old daughter at the time that was also there in the home, and Dr. King stayed in the front room that faced the street, which was called, which is now Amelia Boynton Street. They tell a story of the day before the march when a car went down that road and backfired.
Yeah.
And Dr. King jumped out of the bed, hands shaking, because he thought that was the attempt. Thought that was the day. They had a plan that when something like that would happen, they would put the small Jackson child in a laundry basket and throw her over the fence behind the house where neighbors would retrieve her and drive her off, and then they would try to protect Dr. King. So these were people who, leading up to this march, knew that this was not just something that they would be threatened with on the day of the march. This was real terror that they lived with every day that they were even planning the march. And so that's the backdrop that they had to negotiate in order to get that third and final successful attempt underway.
Your family has very personal memories of the events of 1965, don't they? Your parents were in Selma?
Yeah, my parents got, I think, a perspective from multiple angles. They're from Linden, Alabama, and that's where Dr. King's counterpart, Abernathy, Reverend Abernathy's from, grew up in Linden, Alabama. Linden is kind of a bookend to Selma. It never saw any of the changes that you see in Selma, any of the type of registrations or voter activism. And so to have Reverend Abernathy, who was Dr. King's right-hand man, be from Linden and then participate in Selma, I got a chance to see the real difference in the two worlds of what Selma was like for my parents then and what Linden, Alabama was like for them, which was only 50 miles away. The gentleman who runs the newspaper, who was just recently and made national prominence in Linden, Alabama, because he wrote an article advocating for the Klan to come back and put down protesters. My grandmother was his nanny. Mm-hmm. And so you see the dichotomy that my parents would face, even just driving 50 miles from Linden, Alabama to Selma to see, you know, what took place in that time period.
So as an African-American growing up in Selma, what was your experience of race? And do you think that from what you're saying, then, do you think you benefited by what happened in 1965?
Oh, yes. Yes. Selma, to me, became the conscience of the nation. It became the battleground where people would lay out many issues and work them through to solution. The school I grew up in was not the school that Dr. King was visited when he was in Selma. The middle school, which was three houses down from the house he lived in, was the high school, the segregated all-black high school that was there prior to the march. It was the integrated middle school that I attended. And so the march and the work that was done by the foot soldiers that were there prior to Dr. King and Dr. King's work in Selma changed my entire life.
And you were a debate champion, weren't you?
Right.
And your partner, our listeners know of her very well because she's John Jordan, who's a regular on our show. It's his sister, Allegra.
And
the two of you were an amazing team. You went to state finals?
Yeah, we did. State finals, went to nationals. I got a chance to – John was on the team as well. He was a few years older than us, and he was a tremendous mentor. Knew him, again, from elementary school, met Allegra in elementary school. And to get a chance to grow up in a society which just a lifetime earlier did not exist in the way it existed for me, gave me the opportunity to do a lot of what Dr. King wanted, which is to have a dream and then to actually achieve it, to have people look deep into my character and judge me on that. And it was a terrific experience. Our school was integrated. It was one of the best school systems in the state at the time. And when I wouldn't completely appreciate that until I went off to college in the Northeast and took my high school yearbook with me. And as my classmates in college started flipping through the yearbook, they saw pictures of prom. They saw black and white students dancing together. They saw integrated couples dancing together at the prom. And they were astonished. These were people who were from New York, from Pennsylvania, from Virginia, from California. And they had said, we didn't have a prom because people feared having an integrated prom. How is it that you in Selma, Alabama, were able to go to prom and have it look like that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, my answer to them was my class wasn't the first one to have it. That started happening in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And so Selma got an opportunity to reset after the march. And though it wasn't perfect, it started to lay the infrastructure for what, you know, could be a great community and a great society.
We think that Dr. King would approve of the work that you do in Selma and in Tuskegee too. Can you tell us how you're making a difference?
Well, it...
We were warned that you would hate talking about yourself, but we got ticked off to ask you about it because it is truly amazing work and it's so in the same vein as Dr. King.
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword of sorts. I for all the good that I got out of Selma, I looked back on Selma after I graduated and got a chance to work in live around the world, and it wasn't the same Selma I grew up in. The integrated school, the passionate community, the involved community, the village that would raise its children regardless of whether or not you had a blood connection, that was no longer there. And so, you know, leaving a great school after college, a school that many people didn't believe someone from the South would get into, let alone graduate from, and then to have a terrific career afterwards, I could have gone on and continued to do a lot of the things that I'd been trained to do. But I realized, just based on the friendships that I still continue to have with Allegra, with John, and many others from my childhood, that it was those relationships that gave me the perspective to be successful, gave me the context on which to lay many of life issues and to make the right choices. That context was no longer there. Mm-hmm. So if a Mark Peterson came through Selma today, I don't think Mark Peterson would end up on this podcast talking to you about the things that he would have achieved and the people he would have met. And that broke my heart. It literally broke my heart. And so I remember telling Allegra back in 2011 or 2012, we have to do something. We got to figure out a way to try to give back and push Selma back in the direction that it was in 1987. And so I did what I thought Dr. King would do and did what I was trained to do as a strategy consultant and just pull some of the initial data of what was going on in Selma and what the problems were that were keeping people from living rich and fulfilled lives. And one of the things that I saw is that one of the larger groups in Selma that was underemployed were Black women. And the biggest issue they faced was, two biggest issues they faced were getting viable places to live that were safe, that were clean, that were places that you wanted to live, and childcare. And so I then turned my time, my energy, my resources to trying to figure out how do I affect those things in Selma. My first project was to try to get the city to invest in aviation maintenance, which we have an airport that was left over from the military base. It's the airport that President Obama landed on with Air Force One. It's a fully operational airport. It's underutilized. We could kick off an aviation maintenance program, and suddenly high schoolers could be graduating and making $40,000 a year, which would get them a very good salary compared to what the average household income is now, which is less than half of that. Mm-hmm. So I started down the path of doing those types of things with economic development. But then in my personal time, I started renovating houses. And every house that I renovate, I live in for at least 6 months, because if I don't want to live in it, I don't want anyone in Selma to live in it. Mm-hmm. And when I'm done with it, I turn it over to a young family. Many of them are single head of household women that have kids. And I give them a pledge that I don't raise the rent for 10 years. And that hopefully gives them an opportunity to build a life where they have a house that I make sure it's maintained and repaired. And I cut the grass personally. I pay the utilities as part of that rent. So it's not a great deal for me, but it's a great way for me to try to affect the type of change that I want to see in Selma. And so it takes a toll on the body to go back and forth every week working on houses, but there's so many that need work. And there's so many people who need houses, but that is, part of what I have committed myself to do. The final thing is trying to then figure out ways to rebuild that economic engine that was in Selma during the 1960s, when there were far many more businesses there that were controlled by African Americans. And so I reached out to Tuskegee because of my fond view of one of their founders, one of the cornerstones of African American agriculture, Booker T. Washington. He's always been one of my most revered leaders. And I reached out to them and offered to try to build out a entrepreneurial incubator of sorts that would mimic what Booker T. Washington tried to do with farming and stimulate entrepreneurship. And so from 2012 up to the present, we've been hosting pitch contests where we try to identify technology and technologists and entrepreneurs and give them support and funds to try to grow businesses in the Black Belt South. And it has been a lot of fun seeing high schoolers, seeing college students participate in this contest and push ideas that I quite frankly believe can be those next Googles, those next Apples, those next Amazons that can bring the type of resources and people to communities that really need them now. And so that has been another, again, challenging effort, because it just requires sustained focus and continuous input to get people excited about those ideas. Unfortunately, you look at the Black community and there's innovation everywhere. And you'll see that in many poor communities. Innovation is typically spurred by necessity. And as I mentioned to you about Dr. King's bus boycott, very powerful political tool. But if you zoomed out and put it in the context of today's economy, we call that the sharing economy. A citywide rideshare experiment is exactly what Uber did in San Francisco. Now, that company's worth billions of dollars because they figured out how to monetize ride sharing. Dr. King politicized ride sharing and brought social change. The Black community has ideas like that every day. They just hadn't figured out how to monetize them. There's a company in China called Home Cook. They match people up with people who cook food at home and want to share it. That company's worth $3 billion.
Wow.
Anybody that hears this podcast in the Black community and in any part of the world will know that there's somebody in the Black community who sells food every day to make money. Mm-hmm. Every day. If it's a cake, my own grandmother, every weekend she would sell cakes, pies, and plates to raise money, to pay bills, to fund, buy medicine. The ideas are there. They hadn't figured out how to monetize them. And so my work with the Selma Pitch Contest is to first show that the intelligence, the intellect, the innovation is already there. Let's figure out a way to monetize it and make change in the community.
It's just, I'm so glad Allegra told me to push you on that, because that's incredible. It just, the stuff that you do, like you say, it's so personal, and it is giving so much back. I want to speculate with you. I'm interested to know what you think. Selma took a step back after Dr. Right. King went there in 1965.
Right.
Do you think we'd be looking at a different America if he had not been cut down in the way that he was in 1968?
I think so. I think so. Dr. King was probably, not probably, definitely the most forward-thinking leader that I have had the pleasure of studying. And part of his forward-thinking was an iterative approach to his strategy and his tactics. He would never rely on a tactic if it wasn't successful, and he always did postmortems on his protest, on his strategies and tactics. He reached a point after Selma where he realized that what was really infecting America was two-pronged: representation, but also our views on how capital would be shared in this country. And that underlying view was really what gave the teeth to the types of conditions that Blacks found themselves in. When a person has no capital in a capitalist society, the choices you have become the choices that you can buy. And if you have no money, you have no choices, because you can't buy those choices. Those choices you get are those that are given to you. And so Dr. King saw that Black companies weren't getting choices at contracts, that Black employees, though they would unionize, weren't getting opportunities at jobs. And so as he dug deeper, he saw that that problem was not a Black problem. That was an American problem. And it was infecting poor people of all colors. And so he evolved his thinking from being just one focused on nonviolent reform to one that was now going to be pushing nonviolent revolution. And that's when he began to think long and hard about the Poor People's Movement, because the Poor People's Movement was aimed at addressing those systemic problems around how capital was allocated in America. And he wanted to attack that at its core. And part of the first things that he wanted to do to bring attention to that was to return right back to Washington, D.C. with a Poor People's March, and to set up camps and to make known the issues that poor people were facing in the country, and to, again, show that that had more than just one face, one color, and that if America didn't address it, it would find itself in a far more dire situation than they were facing in 1965 if these issues weren't addressed. So, yes, I think if Dr. King had survived the assassination attempt and could have continued with this movement, he would have brought forth many of the problems that we're now starting to feel the effects of, the types of economies where we hear language like the 1%. That issue would have been addressed in the 60s, and we'd probably be facing on a global level a different type of world where more people would have access to the capital and the means to live the type of life that Dr. King envisioned.
I'm wary of ever putting words into people's mouths and thoughts into people's heads when they're not there to do it themselves. But do you think you'd be disappointed to have seen America 60 years later, to have seen that Wendy's on fire?
I think he would. I think he would have been, I think he'd be heartbroken on what Selma looks like today versus the Selma he showed up into. The Selma he showed up into, he didn't have social media, but he had social clubs like Jack and Jill that could link him to individuals of means that could share their resources with him because discrimination didn't allow him to stay in hotels. So he had a network of people who had resources that could allow him to move the movement forward. If he tried to come to Selma today, I don't think it would be as easy as it was in 1965, because those resources aren't there to give him. And what I mean by that is not just rich people. When Dr. King was at Dr. Jackson's house, there were as many as 20 other leaders, Andrew Young and others, who were coming back and forth and staying in that same house with the Jacksons. So you got 20 to 25 people sleeping under one roof, planning the march, and Dr. Jackson has to feed all of those people. They go to Dr. King like they did with the telephone bill and say, we can't continue to feed 20 to 25 people three meals a day. Dr. King didn't have money to pay them, but he did have the ability to, again, go back to that network of pastors, that social club, and he sent the call out to Black farmers that we need food to feed the people who are planning this march. By that afternoon, they say there was a traffic jam. Now, there never was a traffic jam in Selma before, but there was a traffic jam of men in wagons with food packed to coming to the Ritchie house one by one, wagons dropping off eggs, dropping off milk, dropping off produce, and dropping off vegetables, so much so that they couldn't even fit everything in the house. That was the Selma that Dr. King came to. Those farmers don't exist today. Those farmers got wiped out during the last big major class action suit where they didn't get funds for their farms the way white farmers did. They only recently got those funds when many of those farmers had already died. And so the backbone of those communities that made up the Black Belt South, because of that type of discrimination, economic discrimination that he was trying to fight with the Poor People's Movement, that infrastructure doesn't exist today. So I think he would be extremely disappointed at that, at what he's seeing now with George Floyd. I think he'd also be disappointed that leadership has not figured out that the tactics that are needed to affect the change were already discussed and laid out in a way that could have far more effects. When he started the Poor People's Movement, the first thing he did was published a journal, a report that talked about what the trends were and what they were seeing in the Northeast, because the Northeast had never had the type of protest that you saw in Selma, mass nonviolent protests. What they had had was riots. And Dr. King said, hey, riots don't do anything but disrupt. There's no ultimate end, there's no ultimate goal, and there's no ultimate objective. But if we do organized disruption of economies in the Northeast, we can gain the type of attention that we want to get to force the economic change that we want. And so he's talking about shutting down highways leading into Washington, D.C. He's talking about shutting down economic centers so people can't get in to make the money that they don't want to distribute. So he's laying out real tactics that have an objective that build on themselves and culminate in getting the type of economic reform that he got with the voting rights legislation on the political side. if he were alive today, he'd go, guys, what's the objective? Why do I see a burning building, but I don't have a burning platform that tells me what's next? How do we harness the energy of people who are being oppressed to say that we can fix this? We're not getting that sort of voice through to the people in a way where that change can occur. And I'm sure he'd be disappointed, because it took him lots of people, lots of resources to get the word out, to get people in places where they needed to have these types of protests. Today, we have Twitter, we have Instagram, we have Facebook. We have ways of managing and galvanizing ideas and support in ways that you've never seen at any other time in history. And yet we still can't affect the type of change that Dr. King was able to affect without those types of tools. So yeah, I think he would. He would be very disappointed.
Mark Peterson, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us today, not only to educate us some more about Dr. King and his background and events in Selma, but to share with us the story of how you are going forward in the spirit that he existed in, trying to effect economic change and make people's lives better. And I think he'd be proud of you. I know, I don't even know you, and I'm so proud of you. And I know Allegra love you, and I can see why. And thank you so much for telling us about all the good stuff that you're doing. If anybody listening to this, we do have a lot of listeners in the US, wants to drop us a line if you're interested in becoming involved in any of Mark's projects in Selma or Tuskegee or in anything, wherever you are in the world, if you want to help, do let us know and we'll pass them on to him. But thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you so much for making this time to bring these issues forward. It's awfully important at this point in history to remind people of the path that people have already walked, because the history, though it doesn't always predict the future, it can provide some guiding footsteps. And so your work is incredibly important in helping to remind us of the importance of that history. And I thank you for doing that.
Thank you very much.
Join us a bit later on. It's been a somber week, necessarily, given the subject matter, but we are going to bring you a Down the Pub session to lighten things up a bit. We have got together to debate the most nonsensical bit of folklore ever in history. At this point, we have not taped it, and I'm dreading what they've come up with. So join us for that. And then join us on Monday, when we will be talking to Matt Bone about the thing that Matt Bone likes to talk about more than anything else in the world, and that is the Hawker Typhoon. He's been waiting ages to get on, and we're thrilled to be able to give him a platform and to bring you some World War II aviation. So join us for that.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.